Good morning, everybody. Okay, Boker Tov, welcome back. It is great to be learning. It's been 2 weeks now. It's been Purim. Let's get back into learning. This is, I got to tell you, I'm biased. I'm really excited about this shir. Let's begin. I'd like to thank Mark and Rina Costell for sponsoring for an anniversary. Metzashem, many, many more in gesund and happiness. They tell a story about a young man who is living in the second half of the 1800s, and he lives in this very small town, very little village out in the boondocks. And one day he decides that he's going to go to the big city as a mission. So, you know, he takes the wagon to the train station, and the trains are very new, and he goes into the big city and he spends a day or two, then he comes back, and everybody in the town comes back because he's a celebrity. Because he wants to, you know, what's going on in the big city. And he tells them this most unbelievable thing. And everybody's crowding around. You can imagine this. So the scene is in the evening. And everybody's coming crowding around him in the center of the town. And he's standing on a little crate. And he explains to everybody that there's this unbelievable thing there. That when he came back from the big city, there's this special thing that where you hold one thing, and there's just a wire connecting that thing to another thing which looks a little bit like a banana, and if you speak into the one, you can actually hear from the other one. And the people are astounded that this is possible, and they say, well, can't they hear each other in the same room? No, they're in different rooms, but there's just one wire connecting these things. And everybody can't believe it. And they say, how's that possible? How's it work? So he says, well, actually, I'll tell you the truth. He says, it's not one wire, there are two wires connecting it. And everybody goes, ah. And sometimes that's where our way of understanding technology is. There's two wires. Now we understand how electricity works. So in order to understand the halachic history, it's important also to understand just the basic history of the development of electricity, to understand what it really is, in order to be able to understand the reaction of halacha to it, or perhaps of Jewish life to it, because electricity was not something that was dealt with predominantly at the times of the Gemara. But we're going to see the most fascinating, really just mind-blowing, we'll call it reflection of halacha onto this new, the advent of this new idea called electricity. So we're going to start at the beginning. We're going to do a very brief survey of electricity itself. What actually put me onto this topic was a week ago, my mother-in-law gave me a book to read called Empires of Light, which is a very, very beautifully written book. We actually have been doing a little bit together. We've been doing a little research on this. Is actually about the intellectual battle between Westinghouse and Tesla and Edison, and the development of AC versus DC, and the control, the vying for control of electricity in the new world. Really, a fascinating book. But at the beginning, and I barely could put this down. This is at the beginning of the book. He goes through a very interesting survey. I just want to share it with you, just some of the brief highlights. The history of electricity, and then we can have an appreciation of the history of our sages as they responded to it. So, you know, at the beginning, it's interesting enough, at the beginning, there was always this notion that people understood what electricity was. There was something strange going on, and it all started with amber, actually. Now, amber is a very important material, not just because it makes beautiful trinkets, and because for those who want to recreate Jurassic Park, but actually, at the end of the day, amber has an interesting property that when rubbed, what happens is that people noticed that it would attract or repel certain light substances. So let's say you rubbed amber. People knew this, that it would that when it was put near feathers would drift away or drift towards amber. So they knew there was something strange was going on. In fact, in 600 before Common Era, the Greeks already had a whole explanation for it. There's one of the Greek mythologies, mythological stories talks about the son of Apollo, whose name is Phaeton, who asks to use his father's chariot, and he goes and he ascends in his father's chariot, but the horses know that Phaeton is only a young man, so they takes him across the countryside, burning everywhere they went, and they say that's why Libya turned from an oasis to a desert. And at this point in time, Jupiter, who's one of the gods, becomes enraged and decides to kill Phaeton. And he kills this young boy who falls from the chariot to the ground. And the sisters of Phaeton, who's the name of Heliodas, picks them up and mourns for their lost brother. And in fact, as a gift, they were turned into pine trees, and their tears turned into amber, which is again fossilized later on. And this is the Greeks understood that these were almost like they attributed to tears of the gods, because they understood there was something very unusual about amber. But there was nothing to really do with it. Meaning, okay, it had this unusual property, but for essentially 2,000 years, nothing was really done with amber until a little later. We're talking now in the 1500s. We have an individual whose name is William Gilbert, who happens to be the Queen's physician. He was Queen Elizabeth's physician, and he started doing a little bit of work. And he found out an interesting thing. This is actually a picture of William Gilbert giving a demonstration to Queen Elizabeth, and around the table with some very important individuals, you know, so Walter Raleigh. We're talking at a very powerful time, and what he started realizing was that if you rubbed amber and other materials as well, there was this charge that they had, and he couldn't really understand what it was. He actually had an interesting description of it. He called it the electric effluvia. So he believed that there was an invisible liquid substance which was being transferred when rubbed on amber or these other materials. It might differ much from air, and as air is the earth's effluvium, so electric bodies have their own distinctive effluvia, and each peculiar effluvium has its own individual power of leading to union, its own movement to its origin, to its fount, to the body emitting the effluvium. So now, meaning, and he wrote a book, De Magnete. He did a lot of work with magnets. Very interesting individual. But again, he was playing with what had been known, and he started trying to make a rigid system of what this is. So his suggestion was, he had no idea what electricity or electrons were at this point in time, but he suggested that there was a substance which was being transferred when rubbing these substances. Interestingly enough, he was actually the first person to talk about the word electron, right? Electron is actually the translation of the word amber. Okay, so that's where it originates from. He was the first person to use this. It's the Greek word for amber. And he did a number of experiments to not just random feathers, but other materials as well, to be able to find out that there was something was going on, and he couldn't really work out what it was. Up till this point, really, things sort of stayed in motion until, you know, maybe the beginning of the 17th century. And we have one of the very unusual individuals who was involved was a person by the name of Otto von Guernicke. He was actually the mayor of a particular town in Germany. He spent a lot of his time actually rebuilding the town after it was destroyed by the Swedes. And he lived a very long life, and he found something interesting. When you don't know what's going on, this is what we find in science, it's interesting. When you don't know what's going on, and you're just trying to work out what's happening, so what do we do? Meaning, we know that amber has unusual properties. So what can you do? You don't know what the theory is, so what would people do?
Experiment.
So that people experiment. So if you don't know how it works or what's making it do, before you're creating theories, people had no theories at this point in time. They just did more of the same thing. So what he thought is, let me do more of the same thing. So if amber has these unusual properties when rubbed, what should we do? Rub it more, right? So that's what he did. So he what he did was, he created a sort of a machine where he could roll a ball. I believe it was of some sort of type of metal that he used, and he rolled the ball a lot in this particular machine in figure five, and he would carry around this ball and more for entertainment purposes. Actually, he'd push feathers around the room and give guests sparks. And meaning to say, he was just doing the same thing, but he just did it on a more effective basis. So he rubbed it more. He didn't know what was going on, but he did it more for an entertainment purpose over here than a philosophical science quest project. But what was interesting was, as opposed to just a person taking silk and rubbing glass or other materials, he actually started rubbing it on a more consistent basis. Similarly, we have an individual who, Francis Hawkby, sometimes spelled differently with the word hawk with a WK as well. So Francis Hawkby also naturally lived in England. He was the curator of instruments in the Royal Society. And what he did was he did a similar thing to this gentleman Otto, and he actually created this machine over here, which if you go to science fairs, you'll see this machine still in use, where they would crank the bottom, where there would be a leather strap which would rub against a ball at the top. So a very similar kind of thing to Mr. Otto over here. And what he would do is, there'd be a constant rubbing of this ball, which would generate a lot of static electricity. Now, he didn't know again what it was, but what he was doing was, he was essentially mass producing that charge which was to be found on these materials. So this is what his addition to this was this particular machine. As you can see, it'd be rubbed at the top when the ball was spinning against it, and it would have charge, and you could diffuse this charge, and it would send sparks through various elements. He was doing this again on a more practical level, more than a philosophical, trying to understand level. That was Francis Hawkby's contribution. Again, this is already in the late 1600s. We find around the same time an individual called Stephen Gray. Stephen Gray was a regular pedestrian, actually. He was a son of a family of dyers, very regular individual. And he just became very interested in science. And what he started doing was he started doing a lot of experiments. He started experimenting with what we know today as to be insulators or conductors. So he knew that there were certain substances, if you rubbed using this machine, that would transmit charge, and certain substances which wouldn't transmit charge. So he understood that there were certain things called insulators which don't work, and certain things which do work. And he wanted to see how long he could do it. And in fact, through his experimentation, you can see on the right, he managed to be able to see that charge could be transmitted for over hundreds of feet through certain conduct. He realized that certain metals conducted the electricity, conducted this charge more than other ones. You could receive a shock at the end. One of his famous experiments was what's called the electrified boy. And what they did was, this is interesting, this became, you know, at this point in time, people had no idea what was going on, so just using whatever the experimental apparatus was at the time, and a lot of people started using it for these shocks, or this attraction through electricity for either medical purposes, to cure things, or as for entertainment purposes. So, here's an example of what was used. What they did was the boy was actually held up and covered in in insulation. So, meaning to say that he was being held in such a way that he's not grounded, and then he was attached to the rod is given him is produced is a rod which is attached to charge. And what happened? There'd be three dishes of these of copper-like leaves, very light copper leaves. And what would be found is that when he held a rod in his hand, or by his face, or by his hand, they would attract these leaves. So as he would be elevated over here, by the way, we hope that most of the boys did not die. he would attract charge where some of these leaves would fly up to his face, which is an exposed area, his hand or this rod, which is an indication that, of course, the human body as well is a conductor. Right, and that was part of his experimentation. This is more of a public view of it. I remember that when I was in maybe middle school or high school, we went to a science fair, and when they used some of these machines, like the more sophisticated machines of Francis Hawkby, they have these static generation machines where they have a conveyor belt which is bringing charge to a metal ball that you can have human let's say you have a chain of people all touching it in a chain, and the moment you let go, there's charge, the circuit's broken, and there's these huge shocks which are, so people knew that there was something happening. They knew they could build up charge. They knew they could send it. And now we started getting the idea that this could go through longer substances, and certain substances yes, certain substances no. And this is one example of just a sort of a parody of almost how far it went. At this point in time, people still didn't know what it was. You couldn't maintain charge. You couldn't use charge necessarily, but you could see what it did. You could transfer it to one from one item to another, but at this point in time, it wasn't very useful. It was just more of an entertainment level. Until actually, an interesting time, we have in the Netherlands, we have Professor Pieter van Musschenbroek. And so, by the way, just for those of you who travel every day to work in the car, I know that Mr. van Wyk is turning over in his grave every time the news 8 minutes tells talks about the Van Wyk. His name was not Van Wyk. His name was Van Wyk. That's how you pronounce it in Dutch. Okay, so Professor Pieter van, right? That's not Van. That's Van Musschenbroek. Okay, that's how it's pronounced in Dutch. Nonetheless, if coming from South Africa, where one of the languages is Afrikaans, which is a subset of Dutch, there are certain things which are important to set the record right on. The news presenters are still not listening, but nonetheless, we try. So what happened was, actually, by mistake, and this is how a lot of things were invented, is by mistake, is a lab assistant made a mistake that when he was using one of these machines, so again, here's the machine where they were building up charge, and what happened was he touched a wire which is extended from a jar of water, and what happened was is that he by mistake touched that wire afterwards, and received what he didn't understand to be an electric shock. And I actually just want to quote for you. I want to quote for you what he said about this experience. It's really unbelievable. He says he sent a letter to Paris and he said, "A new but terrible experience which I advise you never to try yourself, nor would I, who have experienced it and survived by the grace of God, do it again for all the kingdom in France." Okay, so he understood that something went wrong over here, and this became the first realization that charge, whatever this thing is, could actually be stored. Up till now, it was discharged all the time. As it was built up, it was being discharged until it found another conductor. What happened was labeled as what's called Leyden jars. It was discovered in the town of Leyden, in the University of Leyden. And these Leyden jars became the first way that people realized that static electricity could be stored for a moment, and then when touched afterwards, that could even last for a few days depending on the insulation. You touch it again, and the charge was released in one snap, and to a very powerful degree. In fact, later experimentation was taken again. We're in the beginning of the 18th century. This was really taken to commercial use. There was one particular individual in Paris who, for experimentation purposes, what he did was he took a group of soldiers, about 150 soldiers, and he put them in a circle holding hands, and the one hand used a Leyden jar, because now you could use the charge, you don't have to have the machine building it up at the same time, and at the same moment, all of them jumped in the air, and people thought it was very entertaining because they did it exactly the same moment. Why? Because electrons travel at the speed of light. So I mean, so they all received the shock at the exact same moment, and people, you know, people did do this again for all the kingdom in France, and this became very exciting, and people made bigger and bigger Leyden jars and bigger charges to see what they could actually do over here. Right, so again, we don't know what we're doing, but we're just doing more of it, and bigger, on a bigger level at this point in time, to try to use this. The next person who's interesting to us is Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin across the sea over here. Now notice that, interestingly enough, a lot of his inventing skills came before the Civil War, before the War of Independence, right? So, meaning he was a very interesting individual, very interested in life. Grew up as one of many children, was not given a very much formal education past the age of 12, but was a very curious soul. And besides writing the Almanac, he also did a lot of interesting experimentation with Leyden jars. So he knew about this technology from across the sea, and he had these Leyden jars and tried using them in different ways. And he was one of the first people, although it was actually William Gilbert himself suggested this, but he himself made the suggestion that perhaps the Leyden jar is an expression of what is actually going on a good rainy day when you see lightning. Right, so he realized that there must be something about the spark that's coming from the sky downwards from what's the spark that's coming out of the Leyden jar into your finger. So there was a famous experiment, as all those who study American history know, where he went out on a stormy day into the field, and he took a cart, and if you can see at the bottom of the picture over here, that is a Leyden jar. What he was trying to do, the cart was attached by a silk string, which was, of course, a conductor, and he was using it to be able to take the charge from the skies into the Leyden jar. That's what he wanted to do. Right? I mean, he felt that if there was a way to get the charge out of the skies, he could put in the Leyden jar like we do from one of those machines. That was the brilliance of his idea. Thank goodness for American history that there was no lightning that day. Because if there was lightning, as you could see, he's holding onto that string. All that would be left of Benjamin Franklin would be the hat. So So at this point in time, he was very lucky with his boy. It happened to be a stormy day. There was a lot of charge in the air. And he found the Leyden jar became charged. But thank God there was no lightning, so he was able to take charge from the heavens, essentially. He was called the Prometheus, being able to take steal the fire from the heavens by this experiment, immortalized by his experiment. There's a beautiful picture of him and pulling down the charge from the heavens. You know, immortalized, almost like godlike. You know, Benjamin Franklin. It was interesting that he wrote down a lot of his notes, and he actually suggested a very useful machine or invention, which is called the top of the house. That's called a lightning conductor. You know, in those days when there were storms. And there were lightning storms, buildings and industries and houses got destroyed by lightning. So his suggestion was that if you put up a metal rod at the top, which would be grounded, what it would do is it would attract the lightning and ground the lightning, thereby saving the building. Nobody wanted to try that. So nobody in America actually tried that, but during his lifetime, in fact, an experiment was done in France, in Paris, where they did this. They put up Benjamin Franklin's rods. They were all kind of scratching their heads because, remember, this was like, you know, this is somebody living in the colonies who really, you know, like, you know, no formal education. They were really surprised that anybody had come up with anything of use from across the sea. But nonetheless, they tried it, and they were actually able to actually see during a lightning storm gathering charge through these lightning conductors, which made Benjamin Franklin world famous. And this is actually on his own house, allegedly, where he put up lightning conductors. And still to today, we have lightning conductors because the realization that they would actually absorb the charge and ground it, making it safe to be around it. So nonetheless, this is a very interesting contribution of the realization of what's going on naturally and what we're doing to be the same process. We go a little further. Very, very briefly, we're going to just... Luigi Galvani is a very interesting individual who, when doing experimentation, realized, and this is, you can see on the table, is the same picture, they realized when he was doing dissection that if you touched a charged rod to frogs' legs, the frogs' legs started moving. Oh. With the and this became the realization that, in fact, a lot of the coordination in the human body is through electric charges. Right, and this became a very interesting different field in the notion of electricity, that electricity is not just outside, it's actually what's going on in our bodies as well. And there's a lot of interesting experimentation he did. I'm not going to get into him individually because it's not as important to us for electricity. But we meet an individual who's his contemporary, Alessandro Volta of Pavia. And he was an interesting individual because he actually disputed Galvani in many ways, and he believed that it was an incorrect experimentation. He was not a very friendly-looking individual. He spent the first half of his life debating Galvani, which was really, it was a great debate and lots of terrible words thrown in both directions. Nonetheless, what was more important that he invented was afterwards. And what he did was he said the following. He realized, this is what's called a Powell Volta. So he said, if I put three things together, if I put zinc and copper and I put a little bit of silk, a wet silk with salt water in between them, and I put them into a pile, he realized the most unbelievable thing. And that is that there was electricity flowing from the top to the bottom of it. He didn't understand why this was. He couldn't understand fully why this was, but he created what essentially is called the first
battery.
This is the first battery that Volta came in. And of course, his name was immortalized with Volts. That's why we call them Volts. And this is an experiment where he's showing the sparks that come out of that, which became the first movement from static electricity to human-made generated electricity, where now we see that there's actually this movement of electrons through reaction. He didn't understand why it was going on. Interesting thing note about him is once he got all his laurels and his awards and his recognition, he stopped inventing. You know, he rested on his laurels, and that was it. That he felt that was his contribution to society, and it was a very big contribution. Let's not get it wrong, but it was just interesting. He never really continued there afterwards until Sir Humphry Davies. Yeah, very interesting individual, young, charismatic, handsome, very interesting individual who rose to fame very, very fast. What he did was he started, again, if you don't know what's going on, what you start doing is you do more of it, right? So he started making many volta piles. So many batteries, and made them bigger and bigger. And he realized that what was going on in the volta pile was actually a chemical reaction. What was doing was that there was electrons. He didn't understand the word electron, but this reaction was emitting electrons which were circulating, and he started realizing that you could actually use it for electrolysis, which means that you could put it into a substance and thereby separate the substance. Right, so you could separate complex molecular structures into basic elements, and he started discovering elements. So Humphry Davies was the person who started discovering that you could actually new elements, beryllium, all these new metals were through electrolysis, where you reverse the process of Volta. Very fascinating. One of the most important things that for our purposes over here is the creation of what's called the first carbon arc lamp, where he realized that if you had enough charge, which was human-generated. Now, you don't need any static machines anymore because you could create these Volta piles. You could put two pieces of carbon close to each other, and as they would burn out, they'd be emitted a huge arc of light. And, of course, this is very important because now this is the way maybe to conquer darkness. I mean, the day ended, basically, when it became dark. And now, slowly, there became the realization that if you could harness these Volta piles and use sufficiently large amounts of electricity using carbon, you could actually burn them in a way that created what was called an arc light. I'm sorry, there's a whole question still in because there's just a lot of material. And he started realizing, using these things called arc light, they weren't very pleasant to look at. They were very, very, very bright. And in fact, they weren't used in homes. They couldn't be used in homes. They were too powerful. They need too much power, too expensive. But they started using these now in public squares afterwards. So, for instance, he has actually a picture of the arc lights which were used on the later on in the Eiffel Tower. So arc lights started being used. These were actually even still used as spotlights during war. Right, so these and in certain towns in America, they started using arc lights. They made towers in the city, the center of town, and they started using using current to generate this very powerful arc light, which would illuminate. And it was, people found it very, very glaring to the eye because this is the first way that essentially the first, forgive us, Edison, the first light bulb. His one of the most important things that Sir Humphry Davies did, most people argued, is to hire an assistant called Michael Faraday. Michael Faraday was a very simple boy. He was working in a leather shop, didn't get any formal education, came to one of Sir Humphry's public discourses, was so incredibly inspired by this that he wrote notes and he bound it in a leather book and he sent it to Sir Humphry Davies, who hired him. And Michael Faraday himself did a lot of inventing, way beyond the scope of any amount of time to describe how much he did. He used to give Christmas lectures where he would talk to the public about his inventions. A very, very, very powerful and recognized person. He started realizing that, in fact, there was a connection between magnetism and current. And this is beyond the scope of what we're going to be talking about over here. But he realized that when you connected a battery through an electromagnet, what happened was the galvanometer, which would be which would measure current, would spring just that second. And he realized that magnetism affected current, which of course led into what is essentially the first dynamo. Right, took a copper ring, which was now by alternating used with a magnet when moved around would generate current. This is very important because now this became not only could you create current through batteries essentially, but now you could create current through movement. Right, and this is very important because this could be reversed and you could create engines. Right, this became the first steps towards the usefulness. When asked about this, he said he was asked, you know, what is the use of this, Mr. Faraday, Professor Faraday? And he said his response was, what is the use of an infant? That was his response. The point is that make it useful. He was so involved in the philosophy of trying to understand and extend the parameters of it, he wasn't really interested in what to do with it. That became the next level. People like, of course, Thomas Edison. We skipped a number of people in between who in Menlo Park, and this is his laboratory in Menlo Park in New Jersey, started experimenting, and there was a race. There was a very, very fast race on this. He created, of course, as we know, the first light bulb where he was able to use electricity on a more, we'll call it, on a tenth of the level of the arc lights, which are being used outside, on a level, on a commercial level, which is cheaper and more radiant simpler light, which was able to be used in homes. And of course, this became the race for the power of electricity at the turn of the 19th century, or the 20th century. So this is just sort of a background of what started off as realization that there was something funny happening with amber to actually human-generated current, to the use of human-generated current. What this means to say is to us is, if we use it today, so let's say you go into the science lab, this is the most basic circuit you can have, where you'll have a cell, which you'll have a battery, which is essentially the chemical reactions going on like Volta talked about, and it is connected to a light bulb, and here you have a switch which enables the current in a schematic diagram. Of course, we have the switch, the battery is negative, is the longer line, positive on the other way around, negative and positive, and then we have a resistor. A light bulb essentially is a resistor, which is a material which allows the electrons to go through, but is hard for the electrons to go through, which means to say that in order to do it, there's a lot of energy emitted. That energy is emitted in the form of heat and light, and that's useful to us. Right, so it means to say we're just essentially making an obstacle course for that electron to go through when closing the switch. And now the question is, now that we have a little more than just two wires as how it works, the question is what do we do now at the turn of the 20th century, the late 1800s, how do we relate to this in halacha? That's the question that we have over here, because this is what's happening over here. It's becoming more commercialized. As you can see, up till now, it really wasn't used. It was more experimental, had really nothing to do, unless you wanted to go for entertainment, unless you wanted to go to some doctor who said they would cure you via shock therapy. There was nothing that was really being used until the moment that we really started seeing light and electricity being used in the telegraph, the telephone, and various other instruments which were appearing at the end of the 1800s. So here's our movement. It happens to be, I remember a very interesting story. When I was in D.C., there was a very wonderful individual, really wonderful person. We were walking back on a Friday night, and he happened to be related to a particular far-out Rav in Eretz Yisrael from many generations back, who you probably don't know the name of, because he was not mainstream, and he thought that electricity was not a problem on Shabbos. And basically, this individual argued to me. He said, you know, I know that not in my lifetime, but maybe in my children's, my grandchildren's lifetime, electricity will become mutter on Shabbos. He says, because right now the only reason that it is Osir is because Rav Herschel Schachter lives on the first floor apartment. And I said, well, you know, that's a very interesting theory as to the development of halacha. But I don't believe that the reason why electricity is Osir today is because Rav Herschel Schachter lives on the first floor apartment. It happens to be he doesn't. There's definitely stairs up to Rav Schachter's apartment. And Rav Schachter is not the person sitting there with the keys to all of Shabbos I'm sitting there, you know, chuckling and holding the power over the rest of the world who's suffering terribly because of it. What we need to do is understand that we looked at a lot of very wise people up till now, people really inventors and incredibly wise people, but now we're going to look at people who come from a different type of wisdom. We're going to talk about people who, first of all, for the most part, we're not searching for their titles. A lot of these people, with the exception of maybe Michael Faraday, a lot of these people were very excited about the titles they were getting as well. We're going to go into another area of people who are chachamim, who are looking to be able to preserve as opposed to invent. And we're going to try to understand how they work. So it reminds me of the story on the plane, a very famous story, but it's really important just to just appreciate this. And that is that there was once Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was on an airplane, and he was sitting next to an individual who was an elderly man, a professor. And what happened was every few minutes, one of Rav Yaakov's grandchildren or children came to ask him if everything was all right. And the man said to him, he says, look, I'm a professor in university. He says, I can barely get my kids to write to me once a year. And my grandkids, like, what's your secret? What do you do that they always come to you? He says, look, there's a big difference. He says, you come from a camp which believes in evolution, which means to say that every next generation is one step more advanced than the previous generation. You're one step further than from the apes. So therefore, every generation thinks they're better, and they have really no use, necessarily, for the previous generation. Whereas I come from a tradition that every generation, we're one generation further from Sinai. And so therefore, every generation back is one link closer and requires so much more respect to be connected back to that. And this is where you see a little bit of this happening over here. Here we're going to go back, and I'd like to do this. I'm not going to go through all the mechanics, but just some of the basic principles at hand, that we go back and we reach back into the past to use axioms of the past to understand the present. The Gemara was not talking about electricity at all. But the Gemara's language and the vehicles of what it was expressing are in fact the tools for us to understand what we do today. Meaning they gave us the tools, the axioms, the vehicles, and the questions, can we apply them? So here we go. We're going to talk about this in three ways. Section one is going to be electricity doing melacha. So what happens if, in the old days, I used to have to pull out a saw, right? So if I wanted to cut wood, which is a melacha on Shabbos, right? So if I'm going to cut and build, I have to use a saw. What happens if electricity, let's forget the mechanics of electricity for a moment. What happens if electricity is simply doing the same activity? So now I have a power saw, right? Not to be handled without close adult supervision. Okay, so now instead, and let's not think about what electricity, you know, like electricity per se. What about if electricity does the same thing? Is my flicking the switch on that electric saw the same as my moving my hand backwards and forwards when sawing? That's the first level we're going to have to discuss.
No, until the saw uses
wood. Of course, when the saw is cutting the wood, that's what we're talking about. Is my holding the saw to cut the wood the same as my using my power? Right, am I using my physical effort to exert, or where I'm pushing this button, is that the same thing? Do you say maybe it's a grammar? Is it a cause or not? So here's how we go. The person who discusses is Rav Chaim Oizer Grodzinski. Now, I've based in Vilna, Lithuania, one of the leaders of the previous generation, who goes to a Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says the following. Here we are. This is a very interesting Gemara. This daf is really fascinating. This is about cause and effect. The Gemara says, V'omar Rav, Zarek Chetz V'tris B'yodai, U'boy Achev V'notloi V'afilu Kodam V'notloi Potter. So what happens is that there are two individuals, Reuven and Shimon. Reuven shoots an arrow towards Shimon. Shimon's holding a tris, holding a shield. Okay. So what happens is that somebody else removes the shield from Shimon before the arrow unfortunately lands in between his eyes. Right. So what happens over here? The Gemara says Potter, the individual who removes the shield is exempt. He did not cause that damage. Because the arrow was on the way already. Meaning to say, you've not done an action by removing, you're not culpable for removing the shield. There's a lot of information. I really want to just make sure I get through it, okay? So here we go. So first analysis over here is the following. Rava is suggesting that if you remove something which is going to be in the way of a moving object, essentially, you are not culpable for what the moving object does. So there are those who suggest, and this is the person who is the Sho'el, the person who asks Rav Chaim Oizer, says, maybe when you flick a switch, essentially, you have the movement of currents, and by removing the blockage for that current, essentially, you're letting the current go. So I mean, here's again, we're not talking about arrows, right? But we're talking about vehicles in motion, items in motion. So now you have current. You can't see it moving, you can see its effect. You know something's moving in there. So maybe at the moment you remove the switch, you're allowing it to go. So it's not, you're potter, it's not considered. Potter means to say that. We're not talking about death now. But are you, is that action connected to you? So Rav Chaim Oizer, the person who asked Rav Chaim Oizer, says maybe it's not. Because over here there's a disconnect, but you're simply removing the barrier. So Rav Chaim Oizer responded and he says, you need to read a little low on the page in the same Gemara. The Gemara talks out the following case. He has the Gemara. This is every case in the Gemara here requires so much incredible depth. So the Gemara is like this. Amar Achinana Bar Yehud Mishmei Derav Matzah. Itmar, it was said. Amar Papa. So remember just the names. We can't eliminate the names because that's part of the Gemara. Right? You could start over here. It's not that, that's not the way the Gemara starts. The Gemara starts as part of the naming. So Haiman Da Kafte Lechavre V'ishkol Le Bidko Demaya. So what happens is you have something you don't really like. So you tie them up in front of a sluice gate. And you open up the sluice gate, and that's the end of your enemy. So what's the halacha? So you in this case it says gire didehu umichayev. By opening that sluice gate and drowning that poor individual who bothered you for so many years, you are essentially killing them. But you didn't kill them. What did you do? You opened the sluice gate, right? So are you chayev? So it says you are mechayev, and it talks about koyach rishon, koyach sheni. Very big debate in the Yad Ramah as to what that actually means. Very fascinating discussion. So it says Rav Chaim Oizer, but these are on the same page. How does that work? In the one case, you're removing a shield and the arrow is coming and you're exempt. That action is not related to you. In the other case, what's happening is you have a sluice gate, you're allowing the water out and it drowns somebody and that action is related to you. So which way is it? Meaning, how much removing a barrier is considered or something which is moving? Again, here we have, well, in the one case, there's an arrow moving and there's a barrier which is the tris. In this case, we have water which is trying to run and you're removing the barrier and it is attributed to you. Again, we're trying to find the axioms to express ourselves in a switch with moving currents. So what is the halach over here? So it says Rav Chaim Oizer, just to appreciate the beauty of this, Rav Chaim Oizer essentially says in this halach, he says, Loi tikshi b'cho v'loi damya, ha'mil se lezarek b'achet se trispi. Are they not similar? De ilu hasom ki salki le tris mikmi de nimti gire le gabehu de salki. The il bosser de matalagabe tris, afal gav de havi misalik lay, the tris tu loy havi ozil gire tve. So what he essentially argues, and again, without going into all the details, because we don't have the time to really get into the kishkas of this Rav Chaim Oizer, it's a beautiful description. Essentially, when I am removing the sluice gate, the water is right there. So essentially, I'm intentionally affecting the water itself. The water's waiting at the edge of the gate, and I am removing it, which allows the water through. When it comes to the chetz, when it comes to the arrow being shot, I'm not affecting the arrow. Somebody else shot the arrow, for all we care. You're simply affecting what's happening at the end. So in this case, says Rav Chaim Oizer, the case of electricity is more similar to this case, where what happens is at the switch, at the edge of where that switch in the circuit diagram is the current is waiting to go. When you close it, it is like the water flowing through the sluice gate you open, as opposed to removing something from an external force. Therefore, says Rav Chaim Oizer, we can safely ascertain that when a person is essentially switching on electricity for something which is doing the same halacha as your hand would have been doing. So no longer am I sawing the wood, but I'm switching on the electricity which is making a machine turn, which is now sawing the wood. Essentially he is saying that that action is attributed to you because flicking the switch is allowing the water out, which is considered koyach rishon of the individual. This is, by the way, most of us take this for granted. But just understand how the sophisticated nuance of what Rav Chaim Oizer is saying over here and the use of these axioms and glory. If it's right, Rabbi, I'm going to hold for to the end because there's just so much over here. I'd love to hear the questions at the end. So this is the first and most important thing. Oh yeah, we're not talking about, just to appreciate this, we're not talking about electricity itself. We're talking about what electricity does. Does it relate back to you by flicking that switch? That's the first step over here in the process that we need to understand. And he says, absolutely, this is considered koyach rishon, not grammar, and that's the first level of understanding. Stage number two. What happens if we're talking about not a saw? So we're not performing a malacha using electricity in the force as force. What happens if you're cooking or lighting? So in the old days, if you wanted to cook or you wanted to light, what did you use? Use fire. In these days, what happens now, if instead of using fire, I now use a resistor, and the resistor is either going to emit light or heat, and that's very useful. So for instance, the elements in our stoves, the elements in incandescent light bulbs, are essentially resistors, tungsten in good old incandescent bulbs, where the current is going through, but because it is hard for electrons to get through, it is releasing energy in the form of light and heat. Right? Usually both. Okay, so now in this case, is there a problem per se with that? Now, you see, we've moved a little further away. We know that it's attributed to you, meaning we know flicking the switch is attributed to you. But is there a melacha per se in the heating of this? Let's think about this just before we get any further. What is the difference between burning wood to cook and and using a element to cook. Just to, for a moment, what's the difference in terms of what's happening with the substances? Right, so the wood is, what's the wood? The wood is a fuel. Right, the wood is the fuel of the fire. In electricity, is the element the fuel? No. What happens is the element is actually a conductor, and we're just using that conductor to produce the heat. So it is a little different, right? So the question is the following. We know that that as we're about to read in this week's parasha, that's why we're talking about this week, parasha Vayakel, Lois Svaru Esh B'chol Moshe Esechem. You can't burn a fire. That's the one explicit time the Torah talks about in Isra Malach on Shabbos. Why does it, Havara Lema Yotzas, why is the Havara the only thing the Torah explicitly says, why and articulated? Nonetheless, so the question is, we know that this is Asur. The question is that Havara? Is heating up metal Havara? And the Gemara does not talk about electricity, but it certainly does talk about heating up metal. Right? So here's an example. So let's take a few examples. The Gemara tells us the following. Gemara is in Yuma. I lost the daf for a second on this one. It says, Tanya Omar, Rabbi Yehuda, Ashoshia, Sel Bazel, Hayamachami, Me Erev Yom Kippurim, Matilim, Soich, Tzoynen, Kedesh, Tofik, Tzinosam. So what would happen is, the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur, we need to spend a lot of time in the mikveh, right? Because every time he would change the begotten, there was five changes, what would end up happening is, he'd have to go to the mikveh. Problem is, Yom Kippur is, it's starting to get a bit of a colder season, right? So that's a little tough for the Kohen Gadol. In fact, the Kohen Gadol was not allowed to vote on the Sanhedrin for when Rosh Chodesh was, because there was a cognitive bias towards when Rosh Chodesh should fall, because every day towards the summer is one day better for the Kohen Gadol, right? So just to understand the psychology of this. So the Gemara prohibited the Kohen Gadol from being as part of that voting. The Gemara tells us that what they would do is they would heat up metal plates and they would throw them into the mikveh, and in order to warm up the water for Kohen Gadol to go and bathe on the mikveh on Yom Kippurim. Okay, so, and the Gemara says, V'haloi metzoref, aye, but surely you are smelting that metal, right? There is a positive outcome when you take burning hot metal and you put it into water. Essentially, you are smelting that metal, and that's a good product, and that's essentially considered makeh b'patish on that metal. Amar Abibi shelo higia letziruf. No, it wasn't that sufficiently hot, and Abaya says it's the dovah shein miskaven, and it's mutter. Very interesting debate, which is nogea many halachas of Shabbos. Nonetheless, what do you see from this Gemara? Just an interesting thing. Are you allowed? Is it considered havara? Is it considered a burning to light up metal and heat metal in this Gemara? What do you think?
No.
Look carefully. When are you able to do this? It says you're allowed to put the metal in on Yom Kippur, but when do you heat it up? On Erev Yom Kippur. Why are you heating up on Erev Yom Kippur? So says the Magid Mishnah on the Rambam who quotes this. He says that in fact this is a din d'oraisa of heating up metal. That heating up metal is the same degree of isur as when it comes to fire. That's a very interesting assertion. Second time the Gemara quotes this, in Gemara and Shabbos, Daf Mem Beis Amud Aleph, the Gemara says the following. The Gemara quotes in the second line, V'ha'amar Shmuel, Mechabim gacheles shamateches b'rishus harabim, b'shvel shelo yazuku boi rabim. So what happens if you're walking down the road, and you see a piece of metal which you know is burning hot? So it's a gacheles shamateches, so it's a coal, an ember essentially, of metal. So the Gemara says that you can extinguish it, so you can push it in such a way that it lands in a puddle, so it's not going to affect other people. Avaloi gacheles shel eitz, but not a ember of wood. And the Gemara then talks about Rabbi Shimon and the debate between Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda about Menachshen Tzricha Legufa. Okay, so the Gemara over here has an interesting thing. So it says that apparently there's a difference between putting out an ember which is of wood and an ember which is of metal, right? It sounds like the ember of metal is allowed, but the ember of wood is not, because of the Shalai Azuku Barabim. This would suggest that extinguishing metal is on a lower level, it's probably an Issa Darabonon at least, but on a lower level than extinguishing a gachele shel eitz, right? Because the Gemara is telling us that you can only put out the one of metal. So this seems to throw a wrench into it. The one Gemara seems to suggest that lighting it is considered melacha daraisa. Over here, putting it out may only be considered melacha midrabbana, which can be sidestepped because of the need of the public, whereas that need isn't addressed when it comes to wood. That's what seems to be happening over here. Happens to be a very big debate. We're not going to go through the sources. Rashi says that, you know what? You know, there's a technical reason over here as to why this is considered only an Issa Drabonon, to extinguish a gacheles shel mateches, or a ember of metal. Here's a very simple reason. It's because a gacheles shel mateches, a metal ember, when it's extinguished, doesn't produce coal, which is of use. Okay, it means that it wasn't a fuel. So it's not a fuel, therefore extinguishing it isn't the same degree of an Issa Daraisa, whereas if you extinguish wood, it would be. Which means, according to Rashi, lighting it would still be an Issa Daraisa, a biblical prohibition of Havara, of lighting and creating the heat in that conducting material. We're not going to go to the Rambam and the Ravid. The Rambam and the Ravid are wary about this. They think that maybe it's only, the Rambam suggests that it is only Asur Midaraisa, if you're actually thinking that you want to be mitzarif it, when you want to actually smelt that metal, but otherwise not. The Rambam, that's the Rambam's suggestion based on a complex argument of Melacha Shein Tzarecha LeGufa. The Avnei Nezer actually summarizes these three opinions. We're not going to go through that. La Halacha L'Maaseh, Rosh Shlomo Zalman says in his seminal work Minchas Shlomo and his responsa, we're not going to go through the whole piece, but he essentially says that we assume that when it comes to lighting metal, meaning heating up metal, it is a biblical issur, like the Gemara implies in Yuma, like the Rambam seems to paskin. And when it comes to extinguishing it, we consider it a melacha midrabanan. Okay, we consider it a melacha midrabanan because, as Rashi said, there's no pecham, there's no coal, which is emitted at the end. Or, as the Re'em, Rav Mizrahi, suggests, a later contemporary of Rashi, suggests, because that was not done in the Mishkan. There was smelting of metals in the Mishkan, but there was no extinguishing necessarily, so therefore it's not considered a biblical melacha. Why is this important to us to know the end of this debate, la halacha? Is because so many things, light bulbs, all work on the same, or this or the technology. It happens to be not all light bulbs work the same. They weren't all created the same. The first, of course, is the incandescent light bulb. This is where you actually are heating up metal. I mean, when I'm flicking that switch and the incandescent light bulb is going on, I'm sending current through a resistor, the tungsten element, which is in the center over here. And what happens is that is emitting heat and light when it goes through that. That is essentially the same as lighting up that metal plate, which is considered in Isur D'Oraisa. That is biblically prohibited. When we read the pasuk this week of Lo Yisavaru Eish, B'chol Mashveisachem, don't light fire. That includes not just wood, but metal as well, as understood by the poskim. And that would be an Isur D'Oraisa to switch on an incandescent light bulb. Very scary. Not all light bulbs are the same. There's halogens as well. Halogens actually as well work based on based on heat release as well. In fact, the halogens sustain a much higher temperature than even an incandescent light bulb. Most light bulbs today, you have to just check, because not all of these are halogens. But nonetheless, this will be like a typical outdoor light. Would be halogens, very powerful light bulbs, have the same Issur D'Oraisa as an incandescent light bulb. However, as we see in this room, there's LED lights. In fact, not all the lights in this room are LEDs, but that row in the front over there are LEDs. The shul changed them from incandescent to LEDs. Much more energy efficient, and also they last for many, many years. They're much more expensive. But if you look in the top of them, not when they're on, you'll see, notice a bunch of LEDs. LEDs do not require heat to be lit, which means to say that they will not be considered a havara issue. There's an Issur D'Rabbanan we can get to in a second, but there's no havara issue of actual lighting the metal itself. Similarly, fluorescent, most people say most of these lights in this room are fluorescent. Is there an Issur with fluorescent or not? So generally, if fluorescent is achieved where this current is sent through a gas, now that it shouldn't be a problem because you're not actually lighting metal. However, there happens to be different types of fluorescence. There's called rapid starts, and there's instant starts, which are used today, because in order to start the charge, you need to actually have a bulk of charge sent through the gas at the very beginning, which is, so some of the there were preheats, rapid starts and instant starts. Most of the older ones are rapid starts, where there's a moment where the bulb is building up electrons and heating up an element in the side of the side of the fluorescent bulb, which sends it through. That is also a problem because you're still heating up metal in the side. The difference between an instant start and a rapid start is how many prongs it has. Okay, just to note the difference. Rapid starts have two prongs, and instant start today does not. Instant start just uses a charge of electrons which goes through, as opposed to actually heating up an element of metal inside. So rapid starts are considered an Issur D'Oraisa. Instant starts are considered an Issur D'Rabbanan. Okay, so they're just interestingly enough. So this is, we've moved away from the saw, we've moved away from the electricity doing the melacha for you in your place, and how that relates to you. We now move to the actual, where it heats up or it lights up something, is that Issur, and we say, yes, it is. Extinguishing it may not be, which actually has the ramifications of the halacha. Let's go into the last stage of here. Folks, I'm sorry, we're going a little late. I just want to wrap up with this particular stage. What about section 3? No melacha usage. So, for instance, what happens if the electricity is being used to switch on a fan or an air conditioning unit? Okay? So, my children actually have a fan in the room. They call him Lasko because that's his name. Here, there's no lights and there's no melacha. You see what's going on over here? It's not, the electricity is not making the saw cut material, right? There's no lights involved in a regular fan. So now, is there a problem flicking the switch to allow a fan to move? After all, if I were to sit there all day swinging my hand round to make a blade go round and round and round, that's not Asur on Shabbos, right? So what is about allowing the electricity to do it, right? So is there a problem over here? Do you see this has moved away from the first two sections, right? It's not about doing a melacha, it's not about havara, it's now about simply this. That's the question. This is the most technical aspect, this is where we get down to the basis of what is electricity. So the first person to really talk about this is Rav Yitzchak Shmelkes, the Beis Yitzchak, in the late 1800s. Rav Shmelkes said a very interesting thing. Here's where he starts this discussion. He quotes the Gemara. The Gemara is in Beitza on Daf Chof Gimel Amud Aleph, which says the following. Rav Yosef Da'amit Shuvai Sechufi Kisei Ashirai V'yuma Tava Asr. So you can't allow, we're talking about scenting garments. So you can't allow your garments to be scented, to place them in a place where they're going to absorb aroma on Yom Tov. Right? My time mishum to kamoilid recha, because that's considered moilid. You're now bringing a new entity into, now you have a scented garment. You introduce something new into the system. And the Gemara goes on to describe the more specifics. Rav Shmelkes actually suggests, Rashi tells us that, what is going on? Yashenichnas becheres shelo haya boy reach v'asur. Midrabanan. Sha moilid davar chadosh karuv hu la'oise melacha chadosh. Rashi says that when moilid is like creating a new entity, so what you're doing is you have an item over here, which you're putting into a place where it gets fragranced, you're creating a new entity. You're introducing into it something new. Rav Shmelkes actually suggests, and this, by the way, this halacha of moilid, this is one example, and it seems very distant to electricity, but the Gemara uses many other examples of where the notion of the isser, the rabbanon of moilid, is. And he, in fact, in his response in Beis Yitzchak in the Hashmotos of Yardea, Chelek Beis, suggests that what happens with electricity is that there is a notion of moilid. What I'm doing is now I'm introducing a new system. I'm allowing the current to move through a new system, and that is the Isser of Yahav Midrabon. Now, again, it seems frivolous in the way that I'm presenting because we only have a few minutes over here to really go through the pages and pages of the Beis Yitzchak. It goes backwards and forwards in appreciating this. There is a debate among the poskim if you can extend moilid. Can you say moilid to new cases? Can I say that in new cases he believes yes, absolutely, and he gives a few riyas for this. This is how he understands the Isser. So now, when I'm switching on the switch and the fan's moving, the notion of moilid is that I am now moilid a new circuit. I've now completed something new which wasn't in existence up till now, which he feels is an Isser Drabonon. What the Chazon Ish's opinion was the following. He looked at the following Gemara in Shabbos Mem Zayin. Now, by the way, just so you should appreciate the brilliance of this, these are individuals who have Shas and Poskim at their fingertips, and they're searching through their entire corpus of knowledge in Mesorah to understand if there are vehicles to express the same ideas which aren't here to be talked about, right? So here's his example. He says, he talks about the following. This is a Braisa, a Tanatic teaching, which says the following. Hamachzir kone menorah b'shabbos chayav chatas. So what happens if you have a menorah, you have a lamp, which is you take to pieces, right? So I mean to say it's a traveling lamp, so you add arms to it when you need to, and you remove arms when you need to. So you'll sort of put in the metal rods as you need them. When you need more light, you'll take them out when you don't need them. So if you do such a thing, the Gemara tells us that your chayav chatas is considered a breach of Shabbos. What's the breach over here? What's going on?
Building.
You are boiner, right? Actually, more specifically, it's makeh bapatish, really midoraisa, because there's no boy at binyan bekelim. This is a detached from the ground. But makeh bapatish is what is completing this item is through attaching these extra arms. The Gemara then says, however, v'im hichzir potter, aval potter also, here we are, kone sayodim lo yachzir v'im hichzir potter. So what happens if, there used to be people who'd lime cover buildings, so they needed to have poles. So what happened is the builders would have these poles, which could be extended or contracted by adding on parts to them. So let's say they need to reach the higher reaches of the building to paint or to lime coat. They would put a few pieces of the pole together and use it for higher parts. And then when they needed it lower nearby them, they would take off a few of those pieces and use it for below and have a shorter pole. The question is what happens if you are you're putting them on, or you're putting these pieces on. Is that considered an Isser? And the Gemara says, it's not Asur Midoraisa, but it's Potter, meaning there's no biblical liability, but Asur, but it's still Asur Midrabanan. The Chazanish says, what's the difference between the two of these? Meaning, what's the difference between adding on branches onto a menorah, which is considered binyan bekelim, the makeh bapatish, midoraisa, and when I'm adding on little elements to this longer stick which the painters use? Why are the two different from each other? So the way he expresses, the way he understands it, is that when I'm using, there's two options he has. The koneh or shel sayadim is something which is going to be taken apart, and meaning extended and contracted all the time. So there's no constancy in its state, whereas a menorah is usually kept in that way for a longer period of time. Also, with a menorah, you push it in more because it's used more permanently. When you put it in, you really push the pieces of metal in, so it's more of a permanent structure. Says the Chazon Ish, he feels in his writings over here in Orach Chaim, he believes that in electricity, when a person has created a circuit, they've created an irreversible, meaning to say, it is a new entity which they've created. He feels that it is considered makeh bapatish d'oraisa. It is like the menorah, where you're adding an element to an item. This circuit never existed before, was useless before, and now it's completely useful for the moment that you've closed that switch. And feels as if it's been new and d'oraisa. This is revolutionary, because what the Chazon Ish is essentially saying is, this is a biblical prohibition, as opposed to Rav Shmuel, because he says it's rabbinic. The most accepted opinion is Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, who was the poisek in America before Rav Moshe Feinstein. And he says the following. This is what Rav Shecht actually, when I spoke to Rav Shecht, this is what Rav Shecht pointed out to me. He said the following. Tanya, this is the Gemara in Ksubas. Nachum Yishgal Yo'aymer. Sinor she'oloboy kaskasin ma'achon baragloy betzino b'shabbos ve'eino choyshesh. So what happens if you have a drain pipe? We all have this, right? You have a drain pipe on your roof and it's blocked. There's leaves in it. So what do you do? So in those days, they weren't as thin. So what you could do is you could push the leaves through with your foot to allow the water to flow through, because otherwise when water accumulates, it's going to create damage, and there's going to be insect infestation, and there's going to be bad smells. So the Gemara says you can do it with your foot on Shabbos, which means to say that as long as it's in private, and for my science, my time I'm attacking kal achar yadu, v'mokam pseidu lo gozru boi rabonon. It is considered a mesaken, you're fixing the system, meaning the system is now has a blockage. There's no way for the system to work, your drainage system. So that is considered misakin to fix it. But in the case of Seder, where there's loss which is involved, you can do it with a shinui, because it's an Issa Durabonin. Says Rav Shechter and Rav Henkin, in the writings of Rav Henkin, this is exactly what's going on in electricity. I have a system over here which is not working, meaning there's no zerem, there's no current which is going through. I am now opening up the zerem to flow, and essentially by allowing that to do, I'm allowing the system to work. That's considered a misakin, or an extension of makeh bapatish midderabanan, which is what Rav Henkin says. This is what is accepted lahalacha, so poiskim like Rav Avadia Yosef, Dayan Weiss, Rav Shecht himself, suggest that in fact, that we assume that electricity, is from those three opinions, not moiled, not boine, but we assume is makeh bapatish midrabanan. Now, why is it important that it's midrabanan as not midoraisa? Some people have the notion that, oh, it's only drabanan. I once heard Rav Shecht say, many years ago when I was in Kerem Yavne, somebody was there and they asked, I think it was Rav Feldman. He was relating one of Rav Shechter's points, and Rav Shechter had said that it's an Issa Drabanan. So the person said, so does that mean it's all right? So he says, no, you'll just go to a rabbinic Gehinnom. You know, equally as terrifying. Right, so the point is, it doesn't mean to say that it's mutter. What it does mean to say is that in certain cases there can be exceptions. Here's the examples. In Rav Nua's Sefer in Shmira Shabbos Kehil Chasar, written by a Talmud of Rosh Hashanah Zalman Arbach, who argued on the Chazon Ish, but in the end had to relent to the Chazon Ish in deference. So it doesn't actually address it explicitly, but here's an example of where knowing it's Drabonin actually makes a difference. Example. So let's say in the very hot summer days, the people, you can't live, right? Mutter loymar lanochri lahafil es ha-ma'avrer oyes ha-mazgan. You can tell a non-Jew to switch on the fan or the air conditioning. Re'el alon perik labed. Let's say the danger is way too cold and it needs to be switched off. So you can't switch it off yourself because that's an Issa Drabonin of Misaken Mane, right? You're allowing the system to work. But Amir La'akum is a Drabonin. So if you have two Drabonins, but Makom Tsar, Right? So now I have one Issur Drabbanan is telling the Nachri. The other Issur Drabbanan is actually deactivating the electricity. In those cases, Shuvas Tushus, Makom Tsar, is an example where it would be a Milter. If this is the Chazon Ish, he would not allow that because it's an Issur Daraisa that doesn't help you. Another example. He says, Shomati Me'agon Rosham Azal Ma'arbach, to be Yontov Mutter Latal Pain, the Gagoin Da, Kemen Shiroi Poiskim, Sovereign to Ma'am Tsar's H, Beyontov Asurak Barak Midrabbanan. He says, making a phone call for a Chole She'en Bo Sakon, somebody who's sick and needing to call, making a call on Yom Tov, he feels. This is very interesting. Why? Is Mutter why? Because it is Shvus to Shvus, in this case over here, B'makom Sochole She'en Bo Sakon. So these are examples of where the fact that it's Drabbanan allows leniencies in specific cases, knowing that it is Melachim Drabbanan. I want to just come back to the full circle over here, and that is the following. This has been a long share. I appreciate everybody's endurance. Just to appreciate this, to conclude on this. We went through three sections of appreciating the halacha. One is when the electricity is performing the malacha for us. One when it is actually heating up or lighting, which is an Issur Daraisa. And one when there's just electricity, which is flowing and creating some sort of reaction, which is useful but not a malacha on Shabbos. And we talked about that being an Issur Drabbanan. Part of this as well is that, you know, a lot of people like to have very technical, and today we live in days of details and answers and with tables and graphs. We like to have all the answers very specific. Sometimes we also need to realize that when the Rabbanan were looking at this, they weren't just looking at the phenomenon and the technicalities of, if I can find a Gemara which relates to it. They're also looking at the bigger picture. You see, even though Rabbi Yitzchak Shmelkes looked at electricity in the late 1800s, he didn't kind of imagine what life would be like today. And you think about it today. Imagine what our Shabbos would be like. Imagine what our Shabbos would be like if, in fact, electricity was mutter. You know, people are dry. People can't live there so much. They have demands on them. Think about how many emails we get on a Motzei Shabbos. We can't live anymore. Just to realize that when Shabbos was the sanctity of Shabbos was preserved, not just from the technical perspective, from the sociological perspective as well. That's part of what was going on over here as well, and I think that's very important not to downgrade that. I actually remember, just to close with a story, I once had the opportunity of interviewing Ben Brafman for the Shabbos Project a few years ago, which we were involved with, and Ben was talking about a particular individual. He had a client who was a very, very well-known client in the music industry, and the client walks into his office with 30 lawyers, and he tells Ben, you know, he says, I'm going to need you 24/7. When I call, you pick up. And so Ben says, everything's good, it's just 24/6. And he says, there's going to be one day a week. He says, what happens if it's an emergency? So if there's an emergency, you'll send a fax to the office. There'll be somebody who will work out if it's a real emergency. He says, but I don't answer the phone on Shabbos. So first Shabbos comes, he's sitting down this Friday night dinner, and the phone starts ringing. Saul, you know the story very well. You were there. Oh, so Saul's an eyewitness. And the phone starts ringing. And the phone doesn't just start ringing. The phone goes on. How many times do you say it was? The whole meal. The phone was going on, going and going. What's the Shabbos? He finally goes back, and this individual, he calls me and says, what's going on? Is everything right? He says, I'm so angry. He says, you just lost me 10 grand. I bet that you'll pick up the phone the first Shabbos. And so and Ben's statement at the end was, I work so hard. If there wasn't a Shabbos in my life, I'd probably be dead now. Meaning, we work so hard. If we didn't have that time where we could be disconnected, where the Rabbanim had the chachma, not just the technical chachma, but the sociological chachma to protect ourselves from ourselves, where would we be today? Baruch Hashem, this is the advent of the other side of the wisdom of electricity. Thank you very much. Wow.